And we are back for an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira, baby girl Madison III.
Oh, somebody has seen the new Nicole Kidman trailer with Harris Dickens' son, and I better be the son. I'm Louis Vertel, and this is another episode of Keep It where the theme is Guess Who Died? Because, by the way, they all fucking died this week, including an all-timer. Somebody I've touted 1,000 times on the show, and you'd be crazy not to be at least somewhat comprehensive about her career if you're a pop culture fan. The great Maggie Smith died over the weekend. Yeah. And you know what I'll say, Ira? This is not a Jenna Rowland situation where if people reference the one movie they've heard of regarding her recently, it does not undercut her career. Because if you only know her from Harry Potter or only know her from Hook or Downton Abbey, she still is giving an A-plus prestige performance in those things. So it's fair to say you understand the greatness of Maggie Smith, even if those are your few references. But by the way, if those are your few references, you suck. Don't listen to the podcast. You're not invited. I'm sorry. It's not for you.
If you only know, honestly, if you only know her from her Graham Norton performance, though, then you are, you're miles ahead.
That's true. Well, also, she is one of those people like Cate Blanchett or Betty Davis or Katharine Hepburn, where in addition to being phenomenal actors, they were also, for some reason, unbelievably funny. Like, this is not a writer. Why is Maggie Smith so funny just casually? But
yeah, so we will talk about Maggie Smith this episode. We will also talk about some other people who died. Unfortunately, it's been a sad week.
Yeah, we get these weeks occasionally here on Keep It where we have to do some memorializing, and we will, so fear not.
And then we will talk also about the death of Francis Ford Coppola's career.
You know what, girl? He already made the movie Jack in like 1995. It's not like we were like, please come back now. But anyway.
We are going to talk about Megalopolis. Is it a flop? Well, it's a box office flop. But is it a critical flop? Is it a artistic flop? We will get into that as well. And also, our guest this week is the divine Michaela J. Rodriguez. You know her from Pose. She played Blanca. She is on the current Apple TV Plus series Loot, starring Maya Rudolph. And she has just released this fantastic new album, 33.
And I just want to say, and we will get into it during the interview, we come on and we hear some noise, and she is literally playing Mortal Kombat. So this is somebody who belongs here. Okay.
We will be right back with more Keep It. Four years ago, we were all obsessed with baking sourdough bread at home. Remember that? Yeah, I guess you could say a lot can change in 4 years. So, even if you think your voter registration is good, it's worth checking again. Maybe you've moved, change your name, or just turned 18 and this is your first time voting. This election is going to come down to the margins and every vote matters. Are you ready? What about your friends and family? With Vote Save America, you can quickly check your registration, apply for a mail-in ballot, and find your state's voting deadlines. Whether it's your first election or your fifth, it only takes a minute to make sure you're ready. Check your status at votesaveamerica.com/vote. This message is paid for by Vote Save America. Learn more at votesaveamerica.com. This ad isn't authorized by any candidate or committee. Did you watch Minnesota governor, former football coach, and iconic dad Tim Walz take on cat lady hating, birth rate obsessed, just plain weird guy, Senator J.D. Vance last night? Well, if you want a 20-minute recap of the highs and lows of the vice presidential debate, make sure you subscribe to our daily news pod, What a Day, or subscribe on YouTube for the video version. After I learned that Maggie Smith passed away, first of all, I woke up from a nap and found out that Maggie Smith passed away, and it was sort of weird dream sort of scape, and I was like, what is going on? People were just sort of sharing things about Harry Potter in a group text and also Downton Abbey, and I was like, what is going on here? And then I discovered that Maggie Smith had passed away, and then someone was in my DMs saying, I hope you and Lewis share some projects that she's been in, you know, to give us a comprehensive guide to Maggie Smith films that aren't just Downton Abbey and the Harry Potter films. And I was like, well, first of all, this bitch brings up the prime of Miss Jean Brody every other week.
I was saying, have you been paying attention? I have a problem where I can't stop bringing it up. I think she's my actual teacher at this point.
So that, first of all, is one of the main Keep It films that is in the canon, yeah, along with Eve's Bayou and whatever else we always talk about. But Maggie Smith is, she's everywhere, I feel like, in the sense that she truly has been in popular culture for such a long time. And what I've had the joy of discovering, I guess, is how many things she was in prior to her American career renaissance.
Oh, Jesus. I mean, like, first of all, let's talk about the two Oscars. Okay, Prime of Miss Jean Brody. During the pandemic, this is a movie I rewatched. And among all the movies I watched over the pandemic, and I watched everything and everything, it is the single most addicting film I've seen. I have now seen it probably 15 times. It's the inspiration for Dead Poets Society, if you've ever seen that, with Robin Williams, but it's nothing like that. This is a movie where you start off and you think it's going to be a Mr. Holland's Opus type film where this teacher has a certain air about them and they're going to be inspirational and, you know, there's something kind of crazy about them, but we love it and it's addicting and the kids come out enriched. It is a much darker film than that. And it's about this woman who is, in fact, a wild, extreme narcissist with fascist tendencies, but she also, in her own way, is motherfucking fabulous and delivering these one-liners where you think, well, shit, maybe I'm a fascist too if it's going to be this fucking fun. I mean, like, it's, she's so, it's a bewildering and complex characterization. And it gets darker and the students become sort of onto her and they turn on her. But it was a celebrated stage role before that. Vanessa Redgrave played it in London first, and then it became a Tony-winning performance for Zoe Caldwell here. And then Maggie Smith played the theatrical version. I can honestly say, after Vivian Leigh's two Best Actress Oscar wins, this is my third favorite Best Actress performance of all time. And she beats Jane Fonda in my favorite Jane Fonda performance in They Shoot Horses, Don't They? So for me to say that, I have to like gulp a bit to admit it. But the one-liners in this movie are just unbelievable. It could be played by nobody else. People don't understand that when RuPaul on RuPaul's Drag Race says, bring back my gals, the way he says girls is taken from Maggie Smith in the prime of Miss Jean Brody, who has this Scottish sort of verve with everything she says. Please just watch it and come back, and I swear you'll be obsessed with this movie, even though every time a man comes on screen, I am so fucking pissed they are there. They are the most loathsome characters.
The second Oscar we have to talk about
California Suite.
One of my favorite Neil Simons. And I know that you're not a big Neil Simon aficionado. Right. You don't love him that much. But California Suite is, to me, a fantastic film that thrives because the actors in it are fucking phenomenal. Yes. I mean, you have Jane Fonda in it, Alan Alda, Michael Caine, his scenes with Maggie Smith in this film, they're so fucking funny in this.
God.
And just watching them go back and forth in the hotel room with each other, there's a moment where she throws something at him and where he sort of like jumps up and there's a reflection like in the mirror of her. It's their back and forth is almost theatrical. Like you could be watching it on stage, and their comedic timing is just so perfect. And it's truly one of my favorite performances of hers.
Yeah. So California Suite is a lot like Neil Simon's Plaza Suite, where it's different stories centered around one location. And it starts with Alan Alda and Jane Fonda.
It's also better.
Yeah. Debatable. But there's a whole section with Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby, which is definitely the worst part of the movie. And then you get this segment with Michael Caine and Maggie Smith, where she is an Oscar nominee and she's waiting for the ceremony. And she's with her bisexual-ish companion, Michael Caine, and they have this like knowing relationship, a relationship of convenience. And, you know, Neil Simon on occasion is funny for real, but truly it takes these unbelievable talents to make it uproariously funny. And just the degree of difficulty of getting this performance in the Oscars conversation, let alone to a win, should tell you how talented she is. Obviously, around that time, she's in other movies like Evil Under the Sun, which is one of the great Hercule Poirot movies starring the great Peter Ustinov. She's in this movie called Travels with My Aunt in the early 70s, where she's this like kind of wild anti-mame figure who takes this her nephew out on this journey. And this is the first time she's messing with our perceptions of her age, because she is 37 in this movie. And it was supposed to be Katharine Hepburn, who was in her 60s by that point. But Maggie Smith plays older, and you simply believe it. Like in Hook, she plays Robin Williams' mother, and she's like 10 years older than he is. And as she said herself, she could no longer keep doing Downton Abbey because by the time they left that character off, she would have been 110. So she was all ages at all times. And it's actually very sort of telling that her signature role, Jean Brody, is somebody who's insisting on being in her prime the entire time she's on screen, and she's in her mid-30s in that movie, because there was never a time in Maggie Smith's career she was not in her prime. She was always this sharp talent. You watch Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, that role could be nobody else.
By the way, I had somehow missed these films.
Yeah.
I had never seen a single Marigold Hotel film until this weekend. And so I watched them, and it was a pleasure to know that they were directed by the iconic director of Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. So I knew I was in for a treat.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, when I discovered that this woman was playing the most racist person you have ever seen on camera, I was like, oh, this is where we're going here.
Yeah.
She starts out just so fantastic in this film, and she's marvelous in them. So great to watch. And I had made a funny reference. Honestly, the day she died, I'd made a reference to the day before she died, I made a reference to Death on the Nile for some reason. Mm. And so it was surprising then to find out that she died the next day. But I love that film. And I also love Othello.
Oh, my
God. If you want to see Laurence Olivier in blackface, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. Does that even count as blackface given what they put him in? What material did we use? It's like not close to correct. Like, it's so strange looking. But yes, that's a very kind of stodgy Shakespearean adaptation, that 1965 Othello. That was her first Oscar nomination of six. Definitely see her in Gosford Park, which is a murder mystery, maybe the best Altman movie to me, the most entertaining one, the one I come back the most times to watch. And that's where you get signature Maggie Smith, where just ruining someone's day with a single one-liner. You know, just leaning in and like cocking the head and, oh, did you just speak? Well, I'm going to say one thing and you're ended. Like, just ending that Downton Abbey thing. And basically, Downton Abbey is a TV series adaptation of Gosford Park. Julian Fellowes originated. Please. She's just one of the greatest actresses of all time. And you know what I'll say? If you haven't seen Tea with the Dames, which is a documentary about her and friends Judi Dench, Eileen Atkins, and Joan Plowright, they're sitting around this kind of rambling estate that they've had for years.
So funny.
Yeah, it's just 80 minutes. It's just them kind of recalling things like knowing Laurence Olivier and how Judi Dench gets all the parts first and they have to wait and get her scraps. So amusing. And Maggie is just uproarious. Again, why is she so funny? How did this happen?
I will lastly say about Maggie Smith that I was pleasantly surprised, actually, that more so than Harry Potter, I actually saw a lot of people bringing up her role in the Sister Act films.
Of course, yes. Which, again, as I said before, there's no such thing as only knowing basic knowledge of Maggie Smith, because she brings the prestige to whatever it is. Sister Act, you know, a lovely three-star comedy. She is just aces in it. Of course, like, that Mother Superior could be nobody else.
Yeah, and so we've also got Kris Kristofferson, who passed more recently.
A wonderful songwriter, not as good an actor, but that is not what we're memorializing today.
Yeah, you know, actor, singer, good singer, yes. Performer.
Also wrote one of the great songs, Me and Bobby McGee, by Janis Joplin, which is just a fabulously written song.
Yeah, you do not need to run out and see A Star Is Born with him and Barbara Streisand.
Because you'll never leave. It's still going on now. Yeah. Please. It's like on hour six, and she's finally getting to the part where he might die. Yeah.
And he's maybe one of the goofiest parts of Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Ellen burst in 74. You know, Martin Scorsese one time made a movie about a woman. I know it sounds like I'm telling tall tales.
It's also a really good film. And I really want to know. I really need a documentary on that film, to be honest. Just like a backstory. I need a full interview on that film. And if there's one that exists, someone please direct me to it, because I just want to know what was going on in Marty's life at the time where he made this film and then was like, you know what? No more.
Yeah. No, because it's a very crazy character for Ellen Burstyn, too. Diane Ladd, also fabulous in it. We have to bring up Gavin Creel. Unbelievable Tony-winning performer. He won for a featured role for Hello, Dolly! A couple years ago. But this is he died very young, 48, a rare nerve cancer. I think I had heard he had figured out something was wrong like 2 months ago. And since it just passed away, it's very, very shocking. Gavin Creel, whatever role you know him from, I think there are people that would argue it's his signature role. He just, everything was nailed, like Thoroughly Modern, really. I mean, we'll start with that, which is Ira's favorite musical. But Hair also, Into the Woods. So this is somebody who was beloved. I loved hearing Bette Midler's tribute to him after he died. Obviously, they were co-stars in Hello, Dolly. And that might be the definitive theatrical event of the past 10 years at this point, you know, since Hamilton's, I think, now more than 10 years ago.
I had the pleasure of seeing him on stage so many times. I think the first time I saw him on stage was in Hair, the revival, when I first moved to New York. And I think that he's just such this singular, beautiful voice. And I was obviously, yes, Thoroughly Modern Millie is my favorite musical. So it is not eerie to me that I was listening to the musical earlier in the day.
Yeah,
when I found out that he passed, because I listened to it all the time. And what I think has been maybe sort of comforting in his passing was just knowing so many people in the theater community and just seeing how beloved he was.
Oh, it keeps coming. The remembrances are so touching. Everybody loved him. Yeah.
Yeah. Just so seeing people sharing photos, sharing stories. And I think there was a beautiful sort of text message that Benj Pasek shared from him that he had gotten recently that just said sort of like, I'm proud of you for living. Not living is one thing I have learned so far during this time that is no longer an option. Ever again, live. If you are alive, live. And obviously he learned about this 2 months prior, sort of. So to sort of know that you have a timestamp on your life sort of changes your outlook and how you reach out to your friends and family. And I know that sort of the theater community is hurting right now. Ugh. And what is a great person.
Yes, at least we have the numerous recordings from him to know him. But also he did whatever that Broadway thing is, where Mismatched or whatever that's called. I'm sorry, I can't think of it right now.
I was literally about to say his miscast with Aaron Tveit, where he did Take Me or Leave Me from Rent, is one of my favorite performances, hands down.
It's instantly rewatchable, too. It's the kind of like performance you want to live inside. You don't want it to end. Yes, what a loss.
And I also want to just bring up another passing that was sort of like really hit me. But Drake Hogestyn, who played John Black on Days of Our Lives, passed away.
I mean, you live with these people. When you watch soap operas, it's like they are in your life every day. It's like they were the original podcast people, you know?
Yeah. If you are a person who even grew up with your parents or grandparents or aunts or babysitter watching Days of Our Lives, you knew who John Black was. John Black was married to Marlena Evans, played by Deirdre Hall. He'd been on the show since the 80s. He first debuted as Roman Brady on the show as a recast Roman Brady. Then it turned out that Roman Brady had gotten facial surgery by Stefano D'Amara, and his name was really John Black. And then there was years of John Black learning out who he really was and his history and everything. And most recently, we got to learn his past, and we found out his real father. And his father was played by Dick Van Dyke on the show recently in an arc. Yeah. And so that was a lovely way to sort of end years of sort of change storylines over different head writers over decades of like sort of retconning his backstory. So it was sort of beautiful that his story got to come to a nice, lovely conclusion before Drake died. Not that he knew he was dying at that point. It's sort of... he died around at 70, just a day before his 71st birthday, actually. And this is sort of similar to a Gavin thing, actually. He learned about his cancer recently, and the writers had to sort of scramble and write him out of the show very quickly. The show taped so far in advance, so John Black will be dying on the show.
I assume this is what Dick Van Dyke won his most recent daytime Emmy for.
It is.
This man, I mean, like, he'll like show up at an award show and like do one-handed push-ups. He's like Jack Palance times three, like just still at, like in his 90s pounding out this entertainment. So shocking.
Yeah. But anyway, if you've ever seen an episode of Days of Our Lives, you know who John Black is. So this was a really big sort of like hit in the gut when I found out that he died.
And that concludes our episode of Can You Believe All These People Have Passed Away? Every once in a while on Keep It, you know, I feel like every once in a while on Keep It, we need to restate our mission statement, which is reminding you who's around and then who isn't. So just be aware that this is us doing our really academic work.
Yeah. But like we said earlier in this episode, you know who's still around? The white Samuel L. Jackson, Nicole Kidman. Because she is in everything, baby. Is working.
No kidding. I cannot wait for Baby Girl. Cannot wait for it.
The trailer looks great. And honestly, I might have to revisit Beach Rats, which I did not love initially, just because I love Harris Dickinson in everything else that he's done.
Yeah.
It might make me love Beach Rats all over again.
I'm a fan of that movie. I thought it was excellent. So as we know, you've been wrong before. So hopefully you'll be corrected this time.
All right, when we are back, we are joined by Michaela J. Rodriguez.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. We make it easy for you to enhance your outdoor living space with the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block, ready to take home today. Build a fire pit or retaining wall with our tumbled Belgian wall blocks. On sale now. Save big on your landscaping project at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
So most of you will know this week's guest from her groundbreaking turn in the FX series Pose, and more recently on Apple TV Plus's comedy Loot. She's been a queer legend in the making ever since she snatched the 2011 Clive Barnes Award for her off-Broadway role in Rent as Angel. And as if running shit both on the stage and on screen wasn't enough, today she's here to talk about her audacious, addictive debut album, 33. Please welcome to Keep It, Michaela J. Rodriguez.
Hello. Hey.
Okay, Addictive is right. I put this album on and I didn't turn it off. And also, it's a short album, so you can just play it in a loop. Like, you can just live in this album.
I love that you said that because that's exactly what I envisioned it to be. I was like, okay, how do I, like, balance the two, because we're in a world where so many people are like, you know, it's hotcakes, you know, flip it over, they want another one. And I was like, okay, well, how can I like get in enough time? And I was like, I want my 3-minute songs in there. Like, there are people who want those 3-minute songs, they don't want 2-minute songs. So I was like, let's mesh these up together.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, no, it's so thrilling. But at the same time, I've also heard this album is a long time coming. Can you talk about the process of putting this together and talk about how I assume arduous it is. It feels like putting an album together is like the world's most like difficult task in entertainment.
Yes. One, the reason why that is because it has so much of you incorporated in it. So it's like you are putting kind of yourself on the line, on the front lines. So, you know, I think the 6 years, I didn't know, but subconsciously, I think it was a preparation for this moment now. I was very, very scared, very nervous, but I knew that I had to get it out. I knew that there was at some point I had to let people hear me on a grander stage and with a bigger and grander scheme. And that was this album. And it took a minute, but it was so beautiful, the journey. I mean, I got to meet so many people. I found out one of my family members is in the music industry, which is crazy, who I worked with and is amazing. And he's a producer on a good amount of these tracks, Neil Pogue. And then Verteen White from Earth, Wind & Fire. Like, through all of the years, I met so many great people. And now it's finally, like, here. And I get to say that I got to work with these people. I get to say that I got to, like, really express the pieces of me that I've always wanted to share and tell this story of this model that was... I feel like she's the entity, honey. But, like, I'm trying to paint her out as this, like, character. But I feel like she's the entity telling me, like, you just don't understand. There's something bigger. But, yeah.
Okay, I want you to run that back for me for a second, because like, how do you discover a family member is in the music industry that you didn't previously know that they were in it and then end up collaborating with them on your album?
So crazy enough, right? My mom. So when I first started working with Neil Pogue, I didn't even know that we were. We just had met, I think, through a mutual friend, Evan Ross. Shout out to Evan Ross. That is my brother. And I remember my mom saying, which is crazy enough because my Aunt Patricia is actually over in LA with her right now. My mom was saying, you know, that is Patricia's husband's cousin. And I was like, wait, what? So that he's in the family? She was like, yeah, that's your cousin. And then I asked him and he was like, yeah. And I was like, oh my God.
What? So,
I love that. I love that. The album is, like Lewis said, it is so like fun. It's addictive. I'm loving, you know, you talked about some of the influence you have for the album, but for me, it's very hearkening back to early Janelle Monáe, you know, that Arc Android feel, you know, it's very futuristic. You know, are you sort of like a sci-fi fan? You know, it's giving a little bit of like X-Men, it's giving comic book, space. Like what are your influences beyond just the music industry?
I mean, there are so many things. I mean, I've watched X-Men all my life, like when it was coming on in 1994, you know, those were reruns too, by the way, because I did not know that X-Men was older. Like much older than me, you know. I mean, I knew Marvel was older than me, but I didn't know X-Men was. But yeah, that was like always a show that really resonated with me because as I grew up, I found out that it had something to do with the Civil Rights Act movement and like it had to do with LGBTQAI people and people who were like just different in general that weren't a part of the LGBTQAI community and how they wanted to fight for the rights of just humans. And I was just like, oh my God, I love this. And as a kid, I just resonated with mutants. So like, I was like, okay, what else? How can I tie all of these and incorporate all of these, you know, imaginative like fantasies within the music? And I told myself, okay, I'm just going to look at the blueprint. You know, I think Stan Lee did a really good job with creating this whole story around like just people who are different. And that is who Michaela J33F7 is. She is like a superhero. She's definitely a superhero. She doesn't know that yet. You know, she really hasn't figured that out yet. But through the journey of the album, you realize at the end she finds her superpower.
Now, speaking of mutants, did I hear this right? Before you came on, did you say you were playing Mortal Kombat? Which appears to be...
I was getting that thing, and these kids were beating my butt, though. I get so mad at the little 12 and 14-year-olds. They just are so good.
Who is your Mortal Kombat character of choice? Because I feel like this is a telling litmus test.
Tanya, for sure. I mean, I remember Tanya when... I remember when Mortal Kombat 4 came out, and I was playing Mortal Kombat Trilogy for a long time on the Nintendo 64.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? But I remember when... Mortal Kombat 4 came out, it was on the PlayStation 1. And Tanya was the first, like, honest, aside from Jade, the second, excuse me, like, woman of color that I really could resonate with. And she was bomb. Her body was sick. And that yellow bodysuit was everything. So, therefore, I was playing Tanya today. And I was with Nick.
The years that have led to this moment of you playing Mortal Kombat today. I'm thrilled to be a part of it.
Thank you.
I think I was always more of, like, a, you know, I loved Scorpion. You know, I really love, you know, I love the shrouded figures, you know, they were always fun to me.
A little mystery, you know?
Yeah.
Sonya Blade here, played brilliantly by Bridget Wilson-Sampras in the film, of course. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. We love the film. We love the film. The film is campy, but the film is, has a beautiful place in our hearts.
I just love that y'all know these things. It just makes me so happy. Are you guys talking about Mortal Kombat 1?
Yes. I'm a couple years older than you, Michaela J. So just be aware that, I actually was more of a Street Fighter person, but Mortal Kombat, if I was at my friend's house and my parents weren't watching, then I would be able to play Mortal Kombat because there was more bloodshed in that. And my parents, quite Christian at the time, were afraid. Yes.
This, listen, I'm not going to lie. My mama used to, like, it was, my mom let me play games, but she, the gore of it all, she never liked gore. So she would be worried about me watching it. Little bit out, I'm like, oh, child, this ain't nothing.
I mean, that's also why I think I miss the whole flavor of the arcade lifestyle that we grew up with, right? You know, when you couldn't play it at home, you could be at the mall and you could play Mortal Kombat. Mm-hmm. There's a bar here in New York City, and I think it's called Outer Habit, and they have a Mortal Kombat arcade game inside of it by the bathrooms, and I always play it when I go to the bathroom.
See, that's the thing. I mean, also, I feel like it has this, like, kind of social aspect where everyone can just, like, be around people and just have fun. Like, it's just that arcade life was so good. It's still kind of, like, bustling, but you're right. I wish it still happened.
So we've talked now about how X-Men is an inspiration for you. Would you talk about, do you have other unexpected influences who, you know, you're always thinking about when you're singing or performing or acting or anything?
I mean, there's a lot of influences when it comes to acting. I mean, you know, Angela Bassett, she was very prominent in my house on the television screen, you know, who else? There are some other great people. I always get, like, stuck even thinking about it because there were so many. But, you know, Viola Davis was also a huge, huge inspiration. Holly Berry. I remember watching her as Storm and I was just like, wow, finally they, like, created Storm. Like, and then seeing her trajectory after that, even being on Swordfish and then winning an Oscar. Like, it was just, those women were very inspirational to me. And I was just like, okay, it's possible. It's tangible. Even as a trans kid, like, yeah, I get that. Like, it's possible. It's tangible. So, oh, and aside from acting, I would say, like, music-wise, honey, the list went to Aretha Franklin, Chaka Khan, Dionne Warwick, Gladys Knight. You know, I could go on and on and on and on. Phyllis Hyman, if anyone knows who Phyllis Hyman is out there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But, like, you know, like, these were inspirational. These were women who were talented. And then looking at the girls now, like, I feel like I'm ever, like, evolving. I don't ever get stuck. Like, I'm not trying to get stuck. Like, and, like, looking at Chloe and Halle and Dochi and Doja and, you know, all of these new girls that are coming up, Megan and, like, all of these, Lotto, I could keep going. Like, I'm watching all of these girls and they are inspiration. They really rocking it out here and, like, turning it. And I'm like, okay, these are, like, true artists, actors, creators.
It's exciting to hear you talk about sort of, you know, always evolving in your artistry. And when you mention, you know, like, Chaka and Aretha, because I remember your first single that you dropped was Something to Say, and that was giving, you know, sort of that sort of Chaka Khan 90s, 80s flavor, something for the club. And I got to see you perform that live, like, a couple times at events, and you were fantastic.
Thank you.
And sort of what were you thinking when that song came out, and sort of what happened between, I guess, the release of that song and then the creation of this album?
So I felt like when, so I'm so glad I can like tell this story too, because Neil, Verdine, all of them were there for the metamorphosis of, and the growth of Michaela J. Like, even when we dropped Something to Say, at first it was under MJ and then we changed it to Michaela J. When Something to Say came out, I felt like that was my first introduction and my first, like the sweet girl opening up, like the girl next door just coming out and saying, I'm here. You know what I mean? And I was so proud of it. And all of those inspirations that you mentioned, like the Chaka Khans, that was all encompassed in that. I wanted people to know that where I came from, who taught me it, my mama and my family, and you know, the music inspiration that I had, the people that were behind me, like Verdine and a guy named Sergio and Neil Pogue, the list goes on, Nick Smith. You know, when we first did that, we wanted it to be funky and we wanted people to hear the funk. to hear the R&B. We wanted them to hear like real music. I'm not saying that this music now is not real, because it is real, but like instrumentation, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, after that, we did a really good like campaign of it, if you will. And it was really good. And in the time while that was happening, there was just like me thinking of so many things that I wanted to be and how I wanted to change and who and how I wanted to grow. The sweet girl was no longer. There was a grown, sensual, but very like, you know, sophisticated being that wanted to express herself. And you know, Neil and Verdine understood it through the music. And when me and Nick Smith first met, I remember, and forgive me if I'm talking a lot, let me know if I'm talking too much, because you know, we don't have that much time too, and I don't want to take up y'all time, you feel me?
Please,
no, take your time, girl.
Thank you. But I remember when I went in the studio with Nick Smith, he said, what is on your mind? And I was like, I just want to write something. Can I listen to some of your beats? And he was like, yeah, sure. And then we just started creating things in the process. And I remember just words coming to my head. And after we were done, I could go on with the story, that would be for another time. But after we were done, I went to Neil. And I was nervous. Nick wasn't nervous at all. I was nervous because I was like, oh my God, no, this is new. This is not like Something to Say. This is technological. This is not the girl next door. The girl next door is in the past now, and this is the future. Like, and how, I hope he understands it. And when I played it for him, he loved it. He also obviously gave notes on it because, you know, it was still a skeleton at first. It was not like what it is now. There were so many components that had to go in the green lights. And when he gave the rite of passage at that moment, I was like, okay, it's time to let the world know who Michaela J is. And her inspirations, like Janet Jackson and, you know, the Michael Jacksons and the Britney Spears and, you know, like that, those girls, you feel me? Like, that's what I want to bring back in a 2.0 form, because you can't recreate that. So you have to be it yourself. And I feel like that entity of Michaela J33F7, she was like, you have to do this. Like, you have to. If you don't, you would be letting a lot of people down, and you can't do that. So here we are today. And I consider myself, this is like my artist self talking, like I consider myself present day Michaela J. And whenever the past, Michaela J has passed, I always even sometimes jog it down on my Instagram for people to know that it's in the past and that there is the future that's ahead of us. If that makes sense, you know, I hope people understand that, but I wanted that whole arc of even the album to see what it looks like to be in the present and knowing that you can recollect your past to get to the future. Like, you can really do that.
Yeah, it all adds up. I'm actually not surprised to hear you mention Janet Jackson. I think of a song she did, maybe like Feedback or something, and that Ooh. Feel with that sort of slick, robotic energy, like something like that would have also fit right on this album. What particular inspiration do you take from her? I still feel like we're at the beginning of describing how influential Janet Jackson is mm-hmm. as, you know, an entertainer, a dancer, a pop performer. How does she resonate with you?
Oh my God. I don't even think words can express how much that woman resonates with me. I mean, the Jackson 5 were always played in my house all the time. I mean, I grew up with that. My uncles, like, they grew up with that music. They were in that time. So, like, Janet was always playing in the house when she was a kid. Like, I was watching her and I saw her growth. And so she's an inspiration to me. Like, she's a huge, huge influence on this album. Along with a lot of artists, like Beyonce is definitely, you know, an influence on some of this too. But Janet, her sharpness, her edge, yet her sophistication and her grace, you know, through her artistry when she's performing, I really loved watching it. I loved seeing it. I loved even pulling from it, you know, because we all bite a little bit. Let's be real. Like, I'm an honest bitch. We all bite. Everyone do it. Like, so.
Yes.
You know, that's what inspiration is. And you twerk it. You do it your own way. And then people are like, oh, okay, that's her. But yeah, mm-hmm. Janet, she was that girl too. Like, she is that girl. She still is. You know what I mean? Aside from everything else.
Yeah. I want to lastly ask you, you know, you are stepping into, you know, Michaela J, you know, 3307, like your persona and this mm-hmm. character. When you are acting, mm-hmm. do you find that, you know, when you are, you know, playing Angel, when you are playing Blanca, when you are playing any other role, do you also feel like you take on a persona when you are acting, or do you feel like this is just your truest self when you are, you know, playing a character?
No, I think I have to, when it comes to acting, I have to take on that character. Like, that is the most important thing. I can bring aspects of myself into it, but it's, for me, what I've learned when I was, you know, going to New Jersey Performing Arts Center, the most important thing is you have to separate yourself so that you don't get enthralled and get lost. And in order for you to do that, you have to learn the character and create a character for yourself. So I do definitely disassociate so that I can still be me and I can still be Michaela. But when it comes to music, that's the thing. Like, it's different. And I can see why a lot of artists can get caught up, you know what I mean, in the persona. Because that's a total different ballgame. But yeah, when it comes to acting, no, it's actually safer. It feels much more safer to me. That's why I love both, because I can live on edge in music and I can be comfortable in acting and know that I can come home to myself and leave that character at the stage or the studio.
Well, that sounds lovely. Acting seems so stressful to me. The way you just described it made it seem like it's kind of therapeutic.
Well, it can be. You know, when I was doing Pose, crying a lot, and you know that emotion, that was a lie. That was a lie.
Thinking about leaving that character behind, it just reminds me of an interview I just did with Nicole Kidman, where she discusses how she is such an empathetic person, and her mother had told her she was from such a young age that she has the problem where she cannot separate herself from characters. Mm. And so when she's at the end of a role, it drains her so much. She doesn't leave it behind. And some actors don't do that.
It's funny. I mean, I will say, when I was playing Blanca, being that she was very close to me, Sophia, not close to me. Carolyn, not close to me from Tick, Tick, Boom. And, mm-hmm. you know, even in Transformer, not close to me. You know what I mean? But Blanca, it was very hard for me in the beginning to disassociate from her because our struggle was very similar. You know what I mean? So, like, if there were a lot of things, even though I didn't grow up in the 1983, I still went through the same exact struggle as that woman did. You know what I mean? And as a lot of the girls in the ballroom scene did. So I understand the I understand. I love Nicole Kidman. Oh my God. That woman is everything.
Well, duh. Yes.
Yeah.
That's a true actress. Like, that shows you that she gets engulfed and enveloped in the character so much that she can't separate herself. And yeah, it can be dangerous. I mean, God bless Hugh Hefner, you know, like that's what sometimes it can do, but look at the work as well. Like it's, you know what I mean? So it's yes, it can be stressful sometimes, but if you do know how to have a balance, then you're going to live. And I remember a woman named Freddie Walker Brown from Rent, the original. She gave me very, very, I say this in every interview and I'm not going to live it down. And I hope she hears it every time. She always told me to make sure you go home, go to sleep and don't stay out. And always make sure you separate yourself from the character that you are living in. And I made sure, I mean, Blanca, you know, that was my little L. You know, I lost that one because I got caught up in her. I got real caught up in her. But after that, I was like, I have to really separate because you have to have a life too. You can't get engulfed and take months off. Also, there's work out there. You know what I mean? You can't get so caught up in a character that's stunting your work.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Well, thank you so much for being here. The album is fabulous. And again, just put it on
thank
four
you.
Times in a row while you're doing anything. And my favorite song on the album is Started From. So that's the one I'm playing most.
Yes. That's the funk. And you want to know something? Verdine.
Yes.
They were all on that one. So.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great song. And I love the album. I love the album, but I'm going to still be running back something to say too. I love that funk. Okay. So whenever you want to get funky again, I'll find you.
Trust and believe. It shall be coming back. She's not leaving too far behind.
All right. Thank you so much for being here.
Of course. Y'all are a vibe. Thank you.
Please. Also, no, I was just thinking that we get so few artists who like reference like the feel of Chaka Khan. And I did like on Cowboy Carter, the song Desert Eagle reminds me of Chaka Khan a little bit. But like other people need to be listening to old Chaka Khan. I'm missing it.
Yeah. They do. We need funk back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we need funk, R&B. We need true country. You know, we can talk about that for days. Like we need that back. But
yeah,
that's going to come.
No, we do. I don't know if you know, there's in New York, there's this Ellie Escobar just opened this new club in Brooklyn called Gabriella's. And it's like his kind of music is just very like the 80s, 90s, just sort of like the funk, the pop, the R&B. And that's the best music to dance to.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And when you hear that,
we haven't improved on that.
So someone's got to bring that back. Yeah. You haven't improved on it. That is it's truly the best music to dance to. So.
Yeah. Well, we shall see. We shall see what it brings. You know, I am a pop girl. She's born, you know, around the 2000s when the NSYNCs and the Britney Spears came out and the Pinks and all those things came out. So, you know, she's got those inspirations and the Beyoncés and the Aaliyahs. You know, that was a huge, huge, crucial inspiration for me when I saw like those kind of girls come out. So, I mean, I hope we get some funk out there soon, but like, This future girl, she's got to tell her story first. You know what I mean?
It's certain.
This past weekend, Megalopolis, Francis Ford Coppola's $130 million passion project, finally hit theaters. We've only heard bad things about it since it tanked at Cannes this year, and now we're going to say some more because this made me want to leave the cannoli, take the gun, and shoot myself with it.
I mean, it is truly a dreadful experience. I will say, it is kind of bad in an old-fashioned way, which is to say every actor in it is like making wild accusations about what kind of movie they think they're in, and everybody is incorrect.
Yeah, what feels sort of classically bad about the film is the fact that this is a project that Coppola has been working on for about 40 years, to be honest. He started developing the idea for it in the 70s. He has been trying to get funding for it, has been writing the script for it since like about the 80s. There's been different sort of versions of this. He had a string of box office failures in the 80s, which sort of torpedoed this film happening. And then apparently 9/11 happened, and this film was too similar to the events of 9/11, I guess. So that torpedoed it again. I fail to see how.
Yeah, I don't understand, by the way, at all.
And then he was just running out of money, I guess, and then cooked up a scheme to sell wine to the masses so he could make enough money for this film. And you know what? I feel like I helped make this movie. You know, it feels like an old school Kickstarter because I love Coppola wine.
So you're an enabler is what you're saying, because this movie is effing dreadful. you sit down to it. I have to say, I had been prepared for it being bad because you keep hearing that people are leaving the theater. And that intrigued me because I didn't know if that meant it was like vulgar.
Skinamarink.
Like, yes. One of those movies or whatever. But no, truly, what's happening here is the movie is very senseless. You have the story of Adam Driver, who, by the way, is on thin ice with me. First of all, his performance in Ferrari, boot. His performance in House of Gucci, boot. He gave me that movie Silence I had to sit through that once upon a time. Absolutely not. I'm holding on to the fumes of Marriage
65
Story.
65 was a gag.
Okay, yes. But anyway, he plays this guy who develops this building material that he wants to come up with this dream megalopolis with, and that's the beginning of it. But honestly, I can barely even explain what, like, Aubrey Plaza, who's playing somebody named Wow Platinum, great name.
Anti-Wow Platinum.
Yes, right. Shia LaBeouf is in this. John Voight, I am sorry to say, gives one of the best performances in the movie, even though it's like comic and disoriented. Talia Shire, Francis Ford Coppola's sister, and Jason Schwartzman, who's also in this movie, his mother is in this, giving a kookaroo performance. None of them go together. I can't really honestly say I knew what I was watching at any given moment. It's a lot of like phantasmagoric images. And then also, the thing that is craziest to me about this movie is, as you said, it costs like $120 million. Baby, where did the money go? Because the look of this movie is supposed to be like futuristic and impressive, when to me it looks like, and here's what came to mind. Do you remember the 2001 Aerosmith video with Tara Reid, Fly Away From Here?
Yeah.
It's just a futuristic city, like just short of the flying cars. It's exactly the boilerplate looking, you know, utopian looking place you would expect from any CGI AI generated environment.
It was giving Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow. Let's be real here, but cheaper.
Sure. Right. A Sky Captain in the World of Kickstarter. Yes, exactly.
The first thing I want to say about this film is that there is a version of this film that is maybe not good, but at least more, I guess, comprehensible.
Yes.
Because there is allegedly sort of like a 4-hour cut of this film. And this film clocks in at about 2 hours and 18 minutes. And Coppola is infamous for the director's cut of a film. You know, he always has to chop it down for a theatrical release. But I feel like at this point, when you're doing a $130 million vanity film that you funded yourself, just release the whole fucking 4-hour film, you know? Because 2 hours and 18 minutes, for me, it felt so disjointed.
Yeah, I agree.
Watching it.
It's like things are missing, yes. While it's still trying to impress you with all these surrealistic images.
Aubrey Plaza and Shia LaBeouf are ostensibly the villains of this film, but I don't even realize that until an hour into the film, because none of their motivations are readily apparent until an hour into the movie. And then especially the motivations of Giancarlo Esposito, who plays Natalie Emanuel's father, and he is the DA who keeps trying to prosecute Adam Driver. you keep jumping back and forth from scenes where he's friendly with Adam Driver and trying to lock him up, and then he's friendly with him again, and then Adam Driver and Natalie Emmanuel are maybe together and maybe having a kid together, and it's just so disjointed, and I have no idea what is happening in the movie, sometimes from scene to scene, and I think actually the 4-hour cut was needed.
I agree. And also, you just brought up Natalie Emmanuel too. It cannot be understated how often these people are just spouting lines, and I can tell they don't know if they're even saying them right. Because a key part of my screening was people laughing out loud at bad dialogue, which is something I do not... that's not something I ever thought would happen in a Francis Ford Coppola movie. I mean, if you watch, like, The Godfather, I mean, like, that's crisp dialogue, or The Conversation, or Rumblefish. You just don't think of it as being, like, amateurishly self-serious or... confusing. Just like all the dialogue in this movie does not feel like you're interacting with real characters. In fact, you know what this movie reminded me of? You ever meet like a precocious 11-year-old somewhere who says, "I just wrote a book, it's 612 pages. And you're like, it's one of those excitable preteens. This is
me.
This is what I feel like that kid wrote, where it's like everything is like outsize and like everything feels like a big serious moment. And it's just confusing. Like, there's lots of world building that you can tell they're really invested in, but it's completely, the mythology of it makes no sense to like a casual onlooker.
Here's the thing. Coppola has like a unique visionary mind, and I love just like, I love him as a director, but I also think that he needs to work with a co-writer.
Yeah.
Or needs to work from source material. You know, you have the Godfather films obviously came from the Mario Puzo books, and Apocalypse Now as well. And then, you know, One from the Heart and Outsiders was a book. And then Cotton Club was also had a co-writer, and which also Cotton Club was better with the full director's cut.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, but he didn't write Peggy Sue Got Married, one of my favorite films of his, you know? And he didn't write Bram Stoker's Dracula. But this was giving Twixt, okay?
Yeah, right.
Which he did write.
Correct. No, I mean, obviously, he's an Oscar-winning screenwriter. He wrote the script for Patton, Once Upon a Time, Godfather films. Again, if you haven't seen The Conversation, I think that is a movie that is under-discussed because if you hear anything about it, it's a spoiler. So you've just got to see it now. Trust me, it's like the best of what our favorite genre, Ira and I, paranoid thrillers. The key 70s
Patton,
film. Yeah.
Patton, also a co-write.
Right. Yeah, precisely. So anyway, go ahead and be baffled by the movie if you need to be, but it feels like it's already fallen out of the conversation. There's nothing to say about a movie that is so senseless. You can hardly have an opinion about it.
Yeah. I will absolutely say go see it, though.
Sure.
I do think you need to see it. I give it a thumbs up.
Okay. I'm going to go live here in reality.
I think it's an awful mess, but it is a thumbs up for me. Because I am like, wow, what the fuck did I watch? Well, I'm sitting there watching it during the movie, and I'm like, huh? I want to give a shout out, though, to my favorite sequence, which was the slumping justice statues as he's going through the hood of Megalopolis.
Right. And I want to give a shout out to Aubrey Plaza, who once upon a time I would have maybe dismissed as like a one note type of talent, and I would be wrong, because now with Ingrid Goes West, that role in The White Lotus, and her fabulous work in Emily the Criminal, I hope people see Emily the Criminal, she really is a dependable and grounding force in whatever she does. And I'm really psyched to be a big fan of hers now.
This is honestly, it feels weird to say this was one of my favorite performances of hers, because I don't know what movie she was in.
Right.
Like you said, they're all in different films, but I loved this performance of hers.
Right.
From the first scene that she's in, she's playing this reporter, and she's giving you more gusto in the opening of the film than anybody else.
No, you want her to be back on screen when she's not on screen. So we'll just leave it there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I want to point out her amazing turn in the FX series Legion,
which is
based on the X-Men comics. She's just a killer. And I think that there is... there's definitely Oscar.
Totally. And I haven't seen My Old Ass yet, which I hear she's great in. So I'm excited to see that.
She The film is amazing when she's on camera. Mm-hmm. So, and I actually like the film too. I think that Maisie Stella is amazing too, but the film is sort of really elevated when Aubrey Plaza is on screen because it sort of rises it above the material, which is a little bit just sort of something we've seen before and maybe something that's a little bit YA for me in general. It adds a bit more gravitas to it. I want to say lastly, though, Shia LaBeouf's character in this film, what the fuck was going on?
We did not need to resuscitate him for this. I'm
not
so
for this.
No.
Okay. American Honey, sure. Andrea Arnold got something out of Shia LaBeouf. And I was like, okay, you know what? She did that.
Right. He wanted to be Crispin Glover weird here and just came off as, what are you doing and where are we?
At some point, he's running around cross-dressing, but maybe it's also Halloween.
Right. Is it Halloween is a good question whenever you're watching this.
There's a sequence in the film where I do not know if it's Halloween or not. So, and also, we're in a Roman Colosseum.
Okay, so just go and see this movie. We'll be right back with our favorite segment of the episode, Keep It.
And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis.
Yes.
What are you keeping this week?
Okay. Mine is going to be Monsters, the Lyle and Eric Menendez story. Here's the thing. Not that it's not entertaining. I think everybody watches this show the entire way through, in fact. But at the same time, Ryan Murphy, I think we have to be conscious of making movies that remind me of what they're making at the end of the movie May, December. There is not a single second where I'm watching this movie where I'm like, this is not even close to the reality of what happened with the Menendez brothers, down to the looks and down to their dynamic. There's implications in this show that they had an incestuous relationship. Nothing about that ever occurred in real life. There's no record of that. And you just, it feels like this was such a lurid tabloid story at the time. And I feel like Ryan Murphy always like tasks himself with the challenge of making it even more lurid, like making it even less close to reality than your perception already is. And watching it, I guess there's entertainment value from it, but it's just another show of his where after you watch it, you know you're not getting anything. It's like bad true crime, which is to say, I'm like, okay, now I'm aware of this crime, and that's all I've gotten out of this. It's just something that maybe I think would be more palatable as a movie, but as like a 8-episode show where, like, now we learn about this character and then this person had this crazy motivation that's also not true to life. Just a big waste of time.
Ryan Murphy, Ryan Nasty.
Again, there are projects of his that I like, and I will stick my neck out and say, when the Madonna biopic comes, I actually hope he does it. I think he will do justice to her life. But,
icons like that, people he reveres, sure. I think that Ryan Murphy should also just investigate true crime stories from the past. I think that this sort of need to excavate the recent past, the 90s, is, I mean, you want something that's still in recent pop culture, still fresh in people's minds, right? But these people are still alive, you know? And it just feels gross. This feels just as gross as the Dahmer shit. When you were sort of, you know, abusing those victims' stories, you know? And I feel like, tell some story for the fucking 1800s, you know? Do the fucking Lizzie Borden story.
That's what
Write a story about, okay? Write about Lizzie Borden and her sister fucking. I don't know, okay? Who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares if you write that, you know? They're dead.
It's weird to hear, like, one of the Menendez brothers speak out and think to myself, finally, someone's making some sense. Like, I can't be thinking that, okay? It's disorienting for me.
I will say that the worst thing I experienced all weekend was just entering any room and someone either saying, have you seen the Menendez, or do you want to talk about Chapel Roan? So that is what Ryan Murphy has done to me.
The two topics in popular culture. Ira, what is your Keep It this week?
So my Keep It this week goes to Ellen DeGeneres' comedy special.
Oh, I saw that myself. Yes.
Comedy special is a stretch.
Both in comedy and special. Both words.
Now listen, I want to give my good sis a shout out. I did laugh a few times.
When she gets into that Bob Newhart-y timing, where she's talking about whatever, not the sweatpants part. That part made me groan. But like the other, like how she's disappointed in pigeons, like that kind of old-fashioned dry humor. It's amusing.
Yeah, and listen, when she's doing some of her acerbic wit in the beginning, talking about scaring people at work and some of that stuff, I think it's funny. She has great comedic timing, but I just don't get the impetus to have a comeback special after all of the brouhaha. And one, come back and pretend I was kicked out of Hollywood. Girl, you're rich, you have an estate, and you got a Netflix special.
Right.
You weren't kicked anywhere. You're fine. And I'm sure all of your celeb friends were still kicking it with you.
Right, right. Portia comes out on stage at the end.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You weren't kicked out of anywhere, girl. You just retreated. You could have just turned off the noise, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Two, to have your comeback special be the like first few jokes, me hearing you talk about parallel parking. Girl, what are we doing here? Are you're like a bad comic in Marvelous Mrs. Maisel or something?
I thought that's what was confusing about that special. It was like extremely quaint at times where it was like jokes that could have been from 1977 or something.
Suburban mom doing it felt like a suburban mom doing her first stand-up set,
right?
Like at the local comedy club, and it was just like, why are you making jokes about parallel parking? Why are you making jokes about what's dry cleaning? This is not new, fresh comedy in 2024.
Especially if it's going to be a comeback special. It feels like there should have been some more urgency there. But then also, when she gets into the quote-unquote being kicked out of show business, and then there's this raucous moment where she just says, well, I'm a strong woman. It's like, if you're not going to like even begin to explain what happened or like why you're perceived the way you are, like what are we doing here at this special? It felt like she was using the rhetoric of like a strong woman to like cover a multitude of sins, kind of. And so that made it extremely uncomfortable, even as the audience gave her a standing ovation for literally over a minute. Talk about something that feels like it was out of Megalopolis. What? Like, it was like the amount of applause breaks in this show is actually well documented online. But this particular standing ovation made no sense. It was weird. It felt like it had been chopped together too, that part, to make us root for her again or something. Anyway, it's a very weird special. It's weird.
White women clapped less for Oprah handing out cars, okay? like the standing ovations were insane in this special. And the aw shucksness of it all.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wasn't expecting her to be edgy. I wasn't expecting her to come out and really sort of dike it up, give us pussy licking jokes, you know, something really sort of racy. But I don't know, there has to be something more to say about being a lesbian in 2024 who's gone through what she went through in the industry than, hey, let's talk about parallel parking.
I mean, truly, if she had just ended this special by saying, like she used to say on her show, be kind to each other, and also go fuck yourselves. That would have been great. Give me some moment of nastiness to offset this like namby-pamby thing you do. Yes, that would have been lovely.
All right. Thank you to Michaela J. for joining us this week. That's our show. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok.
You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are Chris Lord and Kennedy Hill. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James.
Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Sheng, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroat, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.